Thursday, March 12th. Madam Secretary, may you call the roll?
Representative Vance? Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Hopkins?
Here.
Representative Story? Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Price Thompson?
Here.
We have a quorum to do business. Please silence your cell phones. Thanks to our House Records staff, Martha Moore, and LIO moderator, Madison Truitt. We have one, two, three bills on the agenda today. House Bill 307 from House State Affairs Committee, House Bill 285 from Representative Shaw, and HJR 31, again, from House State Affairs. We're going to start with House Bill 307, expanding prisoner access to computers. This committee bill is a concept that came out of the hearings we did with the Department of Corrections and stakeholders on reentry programs. This is the second hearing in House State Affairs, and I think to begin, I might look to Co-Chair Christ Tompkins. Oh, and Representative Vance has joined us, and at this time, I might look to Co-Chair Christ Tompkins for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number one, work order A.2.
And I'll object for discussion purposes.
Thanks. I'll speak briefly to this amendment. Representative Clayman, who is our partner on a lot of criminal justice issues, suggested that we consider including health care. It's important that folks reentering maintain health coverage, not least for addiction treatment. So this will assist with that, including through Medicaid. Do members have further questions about the amendment?
Mr. Chair, can I suggest the DOC speak to the amendment? Or whether DOC supports the amendment, and if there are any other sort of comments the agency has.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs. For the record, Kelly Howell, legislative liaison, special assistant to the commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
And for the record, I'm Laura Brooks. I'm the division manager for the Division of Health and Rehabilitation Services for the Department of Corrections.
And to the co-chair, the Department of Corrections in the language that was in the initial version of the bill intended for it to apply to those types of situations, including application for health benefits and the like. So we have no concern adding that for further clarity.
Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we've talked a fair bit in committee about prisoners as they're reentering having access to IDs, identifications. This does not assist with that because you have to go into in person and things like that, correct?
Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, this particular section of the bill does not. However, there are other sections in the statute where the department does assist offenders who are reentering with obtaining a state ID. There is a bill in the other body that specifically makes that stronger by requiring further collaboration between the Department of Administration and the Department of Corrections. So although it's not addressed in this particular bill, the section of this bill, it is something that the department does work towards.
Representative Thompson, if you don't have any follow-ups. Okay.
Again, I haven't put this together in my own head here yet. On this health care, if I remember right, Medicaid won't cover anybody while they're in the facility and incarcerated. The only time it would cover them is if they were to leave the facility and go into a hospital. And am I mixing things up?
Through the chair to Representative Thompson, you are correct in that Medicaid, through federal regulation, does not allow us to charge for inmate health care while they're incarcerated unless they go to a hospital for 24 hours or more. What this could help us do is assist inmates in applying for Medicaid as part of their reentry plan. Currently, offenders can they fill out paper applications 30 days prior to release. That has caused quite a backlog with, understandably, through the Department of Health and Social Services, because typically Medicaid applications now are electronic. So this would allow the offenders to apply for Medicaid while they're incarcerated, submit it electronically, and, you know, alleviate some of that backlog through DHSS as well.
Thank you.
Representative Story joins us at 3:05. Are there further questions on the amendment?
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Are there other objections to this amendment? Seeing none, that amendment passes. Let's see. Are there, Representative Christ-Tompkins, do you have additional remarks on House Bill 307 before we go to committee questions or public testimony?
Mr. Chair, no, other than I think it's an area where there's broad support in the legislature, and it's refreshing to see the agency identify statutory changes. Although I guess I just have one quick question for the agency, which is what is the bill in the Senate that is prescribing or helping foster greater collaboration between DOC and DOA in terms of securing IDs for inmates upon release?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's Senate Bill 209, and it actually has a hearing in Senate State Affairs at 3:30.
Terrific. Well, I'll shut up so that you can get over there.
I might ask a further question. How extensive is the language regarding coordination with DOA?
Mr. Co-Chair, the bill does a couple of things. It requires the Department of Administration to mail to a Department of Corrections facility at the applicant's request the identification, date identification or driver's license, so it requires that. It requires that the Department of Administration and the Department of Corrections collaborate in good faith to ensure that inmates who are releasing, I should clarify, inmates who are sentenced to an active term of imprisonment of 120 days or more are provided with a state identification card prior to release. So that's the portion where there's the enhanced collaboration. And the Department of Administration and Department of Corrections have been working towards that. So that's something that we've been doing and are continuing to support.
Okay. Well, I guess to me that raises the question of whether we should add corresponding language to this bill before passing it, or hope that that bill makes it to the House. And I don't know if, do you have an opinion on that, Ms. Howell? Or I'm interested in what committee members think, too. I guess I was unaware of it and want to do what makes the most sense.
Mr. Co-Chair, the department doesn't necessarily have a position, although I can't imagine we would be opposed to inserting that language.
Okay. My co-chair points out it could be added in Judiciary, the next committee referral. So I guess if committee members think it makes sense, I might suggest we stay on track and work to move this bill today, and then follow up with Chair Clayman and see if we can add corresponding language in Judiciary, just so we have two potential paths forward to encourage such collaboration. Does that make sense? Okay. Are there further committee questions on this bill? Seeing none, is there anyone, I don't see anyone online to offer public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer public testimony on House Bill 307? Okay, I guess I should have formally opened public testimony. Is there anyone who wishes to offer public testimony? Not seeing anyone in the room or online, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 307. Does anyone have remarks on this bill before we consider moving it from committee? Representative Vance.
I just want to thank the department for being responsive to my questions and concerns about the language that was being added, and appreciate the clarification and, you know, working to make this, you know, more of in the intent of what you're wanting to use the computers for. So thank you for that.
Representative Story.
Yeah, I'm pleased to see this, and I'm glad we'll be passing out of committee today.
Okay, I certainly appreciate the department's collaboration as well. Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, I move committee report for HB 307-31-LS1663-A. It's an Alfred, as amended, from committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Are there objections? Not seeing any. That motion passes without objection with the zero fiscal note, and we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record in House State Affairs, next up we have House Bill 285, Alaska Coordinate System of 2022, from the intrepid Representative Shaw and his staff. This is the second hearing in House State Affairs. We have not received any amendments. Does the sponsor wish to offer additional remarks at this time?
Yes, and my staff will be filling in for me on that.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Walden.
For the record, Josh Walton, staff to Representative Shaw. I don't actually have additional remarks, but if there are any questions or anything of that nature.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you guys heard from or talked to any surveyors or people that would be implementing this new system outside of just the department?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, we have heard from and I'm trying to remember the name of the trade organization, but I think it's the Association of Landowners or Land Surveyors. And I hate to speak for them, but what they expressed to our office was that they didn't have an issue with anything in the bill. And they brought to our attention that the language in the bill defines an American foot as a unit of measurement, and they say, well, that's a little noted that that's different from the international foot, which is slightly different. That difference can, when we're dealing with surveys of large size, that difference can be, it's a small difference, but the sum of small differences is not necessarily a small difference. So I'm not sure that there's anything that's called for as far as a change to the statute for that. But those were the only things that were mentioned.
Well,
I hope that's satisfactory, and again, I don't want to speak for that.
Certainly for today it is, and it goes to resources next, so maybe we'll just make sure we get some of them either on board or a letter from them or something for the Resources Committee, and we can certainly don't want to hold it up here.
And Marty Parsons and Gwen Gervellis are online from the Division of Mining, Land, and Water if members have questions for them. Are there further questions for the sponsor or his staff or staff from the department? Representative Vance.
This is just more of a point of clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It took us a while to figure out what kind of questions to ask before we're like, what is this? But when the word software was used, I think that was kind of one of the questions that I had was, how would this be implemented and the transition from the software and technology that we have now? And one of the last comments that was made was that one of the federal departments is going to create and initiate software that implements this. Did I hear that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that was mentioned, I think, by Gwen Gervellis at the last hearing, she did specify that the coordinate system is being developed by the National Geodetic Survey. And so what the bill is doing is it's just making it possible for state agencies to adopt the latest and greatest of these. The equipment already exists. In fact, the equipment can one of the things that we heard 2 days ago was that the current existing equipment is already able to identify coordinates using this new plane coordinate system. And that the transition is expected to be very smooth, but I can certainly kick it over to Gwen, who's online, if she would like to answer with more clarity and precision than I can.
Thank you. I do have a follow-up question of, do we know when this coordinates and software is going to be available? Is it by 2022? Do they have a timeline?
Ms. Gervellis, are you online?
No. For the record, this is Gwen Gravelis, Survey Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources, Mining, Land, and Water. Representative Vance, through the chair, the software vendors are currently working with NGS to provide the transition that they'll need. They are pre-beta testing at this time, and when the coordinate system is rolled out in January of 2022, everything will be available. So the users will access this through pull-down menus the way they do right now for NAT 83.
Follow-up. Does this come at an additional cost to the state?
Representative Vance, through the chair, no, it does not.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. Do other committee members have questions? Okay. Not seeing any. I'm going to open up public testimony on House Bill 285. Are there people in the room who wish to testify on this legislation? I'm not seeing anyone online who wishes to testify on this bill, so I'm going to close public testimony. Does the sponsor want to make remarks before we take action on this bill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Christ Tompkins, do we have a motion?
I move the committee report for HB 285/31-LS1595/A from committee with attached serial fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Are there objections? Not seeing any. That motion passes from committee without objection and with a zero fiscal note and individual recommendations. At this time, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Record and House State Affairs. Next on the agenda, HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment Permanent Fund, POMV Earnings. First hearing in House State Affairs. Representative Christ Tompkins and his staff are going to make a presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins. HJR 31 is a constitutional amendment that is pursuant from a resolution from the Permanent Fund Corporation trustees stating support for a endowment model, in other words, constitutionally protecting the entirety of the permanent fund under a percent of market value structures, which effectively protects the permanent fund from being overspent, from more than a sustainable amount being taken out of the fund in any given year. There's two comments I want to be sure to put on the record. The first is we have a CS, which is basically a technical cleanup in terms of tightening some language in consultation with a permanent fund corporation. And then the second point I want to put on the record is there's in this iteration of the bill what one might call an escape hatch that allows for an unsustainable amount of money beyond the 5% draw to be taken out of the fund in any one year, but with a 5/6 sort of super majority vote. And the idea is that only in the most extraordinary and exceptional of circumstances should the legislature be allowed to overspend the permanent fund. And natural disasters might come to mind, like the 64 earthquake, that kind of situation. Although we are in dialogue with the Permanent Fund Corporation about that provision and the best way to sort of approach or structure the escape hatch. But that is HJR 31 and also the explanation of the CS.
Thank you. And we do have Emily Nauman online if people have questions about how it's drafted. Representative Vance.
I just want a clarification of what CS we are working from, just for the record.
Ah, okay. I believe we're working with 31-LS1566-S. Is that correct? Okay.
Thank you.
I think that's the original one.
Let's take a brief at ease for members to find the right one, and if they don't have it, we can make a quick copy, okay? Brief at ease. plan was to do the sponsor presentation and then adopt the CS, version S. If it makes sense, we can just proceed with that. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Sure, Mr. Chair. And can speak to the explanation of changes on version S. It's basically just tightening language on recommendation from the Permanent Fund Corp, but can dive into the specific changes. But this is effectively the legislation. It's constitutionally protecting the entirety of the Permanent Fund from overspending.
Okay. Well, I guess with that, I will move that the committee adopt work draft 31-LS15666/S as a working document for HJR 31. Are there objections? Not seeing any. That version is adopted as the working document. I believe the sponsor has actually explained changes in the CS. So with that, perhaps it makes sense to have questions from committee members about the underlying legislation. Do committee members have questions? Representative Thompson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit confused. This 5/6 of the members, if they want to take more than 5%, is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, yes, that's the sort of escape hatch mechanism that I referred to
follow-up
originally.
Yes. And so this is to put it in the Constitution?
Correct. Representative Thompson, through the chair. So the whole permanent fund would be constitutionally protected, similar to how at present the corpus or the principal is constitutionally protected. But there's sort of an escape hatch built in that if the legislature wanted to overdraw or take more than a sustainable amount in any given year in sort of exceptional, extraordinary circumstances, a 5/6 vote would permit that.
Yes. Follow up? In our present fiscal situation that we're in, I don't want to see us tie our hands to where that we can't provide public safety, health, and a bunch of other things. This would take a vote of 34 House members and 17 Senate members in order to try to provide services for the state, especially since we're going into a situation at the present time where that we are really upside down financially. This would tie our hands where that we wouldn't be able to provide public safety maybe or schools. I mean, this scares me a bit. This has all happened so fast with the oil prices crash, the stock market down. We don't have the money to fulfill our budget that we have at the present time. Are we going to tie our hands so tight that we aren't going to be able to provide necessary public services?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, it's a great question. The alternative answer to the question you're asking is that we spend down the permanent fund itself, which is the ultimate in kicking the can down the road. So in the present situation, the legislature has a variety of options available to it, as we all know, namely cutting the budget, raising revenues, can bond. I think the idea is whether we're truly going to regard the permanent fund as permanent or we're going to regard the permanent fund as a savings account that we can spend down similar to the SBR and the CPR. And unless we make that decision that the permanent fund is not a savings account that we can spend down, then we probably will. And future generations of Alaskans will be in a far worse position than we are now.
Follow up.
Yeah, and actually, I'm fine with just indefinite follow-ups without asking, just in general.
There are ways for the permanent fund corpus to be drawn down. There's a couple of ways. The federal government could tell us, hey, you guys will be paying these retirement funds to these employees, and they could demand that we spend the principal to pay those in case we are broke. Now, there is a second way, and I can't remember which one it was, but there's two different ways that we could actually draw down the corpus of the permanent fund, and one would be by a requirement by the federal government to pay retirement funds. So, but yeah, this is a pretty steep climb, in case we are into that type of a situation. So I'll hear the rest of the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, I mean, I think it's a good point, Representative Thompson. I think the permanent fund through the resolution that the trustees passed is actually, this version is pretty lenient and arguably even a slippery slope by even providing an escape hatch into the principal of the fund. In listening to the trustees' discussion or talking with the corporation, I don't want to speak for them. They'll be here on Tuesday and they can speak for themselves. But I think all equal, there's actually a preference that there isn't an escape hatch and that the permanent fund is a true endowment that is permanent, that is managed for intergenerational equity and the benefit, long-term benefit of the state. So that the existence of an escape hatch, whether it is there or not, it's a major policy call. And, you know, to be honest, I'm a little uncomfortable with it even existing and would rather just see the whole fund managed for a 5% or a sustainable draw. What this would do is it really forces the legislature to balance its budget and some combination of cut spending and raise revenues, but not treat the permanent fund as a savings account it could spend down.
So I might ask a question at this point. Doesn't this functionally constitute pretty strict spending cap that would be in the Constitution?
Representative Chair Fields, on it's sort of a supply side spending cap instead of the permanent fund being a spigot of cash that can be open beyond a sustainable amount by putting the legislature within confines of only a sustainable draw from the permanent fund. Given how the state presently gets its revenue, this would be what, two-thirds to three-quarters of all general fund revenue it already is at present, at least in the current operating budget. So it effectively would constitute a spending cap for that two-thirds right. to three-quarters of the budget.
Do other members have questions? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that this will – when this bill leaves here, it goes to judiciary and then also to finance?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of questions and concerns, and
you may proceed.
One of the and I appreciate Representative Christ Tompkins for just engaging me on this, and we met with Angela Rodell of the corporation and walked me through a timeline in use of the ERA that was very helpful, and would invite us at some point in this body to have her come in and give us that same synopsis in layman's terms. But my question is regarding the 5% average draw, because learning about the long-term sustainability, do you feel that the 5% is an accurate and sustainable draw at this point? Because in the resolution from the APFC board, they mentioned the 5% draw and recommends having, quote, the board recommends having a mechanism built in the state law that would require APFC to revisit this return assumption every few years. But if we have the 5% in the Constitution, we're locking that in and not recognizing the request of the corporation and also my concerns about the sustainability of the fund over the long term.
Representative Vance, through the chair, it's a great question. I sometimes question, what percentage of the legislature sort of has a sense of the difference between real value and nominal value in terms of thinking about our funds and therefore sort of how we're managing them. But with 5%, I mean, that's like based on floor speeches and other public comments. But I mean, most of the analysis shows that a 5% draw, if the legislature goes up to the full 5%, and I mean, it's worth noting that, you know, if you put a 5% draw in the Constitution, the legislature wouldn't necessarily have to go to the 5%. It could draw 4.8 or 4.7, but I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that in most, if not all years, the legislature is probably going to draw the full maximum amount because it makes balancing the budget that much more possible. That the fund effectively loses value. The value of the fund is eroded through time in real terms. Mm-hmm. So nominally, the fund grows, and you know, we hear about like an $80 billion, or $85 billion, or $100 billion permanent fund. But those figures are almost always in nominal terms, and the real value of the fund is in 2020 dollars, you know, staying at $60-odd billion or slightly shrinking through time, which is like a huge and fundamental question the legislature needs to confront, which is, are we going to manage the permanent fund for growth, for real growth, not just nominal growth, or are we, the legislature, going to manage the permanent fund and just maintain it and basically say, we're done growing it, we've made the decision, we're not going to grow the permanent fund, we're just going to keep it at its current level and just continue to draw on that. And at 5%, a 5% draw basically says that we're not going to take the growth option with the permanent fund. We're just going to maintain the permanent, the maintenance option. A lower draw, like 4.75, provides for growth in real terms. I mean, I defer to the will of the legislature, and I suspect that that will get hashed out in finance. I prefer short-term pain and long-term gain. I would rather us have a smaller draw that manages the fund for growth in the long term. And you know, there might be ways that you can balance that out by taking a one-time withdrawal from the permanent fund as you constitutionally put in the POMV draw, that could provide some sort of shock absorption and sort of bridge you through those first years when you're kind of on a diet with, like, say, a 4.75% draw. Your question, like, homes in at that real question, which is, are we going to manage the fund for growth, or are we going to maintain the fund? And just because you referenced the trustee resolution, they talk about the wisdom of a 4.75% or a 5% draw in the ERA, and there's the scenario of an ERA shortfall that we often discuss in the current structure of the fund. And I think one of the huge upsides of protecting the entirety of the fund and collapsing the ERA and the principal into one principal, because why have an ERA if the whole thing is protected, is that you never have to worry about ERA shortfalls. That is a problem that will never exist again. So that part of the trustee resolution just refers to this, like, current construct of the permanent fund that we have, if that makes sense.
Follow up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for that. I still would love – I have so many more questions from Angela Rodell as to how the ERA is managed versus the corpus. And it's still very convoluted, you know, publicly. So I welcome that, engagement. But an additional question is on the first page regarding the 25% of the mineral leases, the royalties going in. And have you considered the statutory royalty or any other percentage going into the corpus and being a part of the Constitution for the long-term growth of the fund?
Representative Vance, through the chair, and first, just to speak to Mr. Adele. She should be available on Tuesday. She had a conflict today, but I know I was sort of excited to get into the history of the ERA. And, I mean, just to that, and I know we discussed this privately, it's fascinating. I mean, the structure of the permanent fund, the permanent fund, the way it's managed has evolved so much in the 40 years since creation. I mean, I think I did not realize this until serving on the work group this summer, but, you know, when the permanent fund was first created, it was this phenomenally conservative, restricted financial entity. It could only invest in bonds, not, you know, nothing else. And in the successive 40 years, you know, it was the stocks, and then it was private equity ultimately. I mean, it's been like a massively diversified portfolio. So in the initial highly constrained structure of the permanent fund and under trust law at the time, per Mr. Adele, the structure of having a principal and an earnings reserve account made sense. And the current context of how the permanent fund corporation invests its money, that structure like really doesn't make sense, which is why the trustees have passed the resolution that they've passed. To your question about depositing royalties, like other streams of revenue into the permanent fund, I haven't, you know, dove deep into that question. I think it kind of sort of falls into the same category. It's different but similar to what a draw the legislature deems most appropriate. Because, you know, if you're diverting revenue into the permanent fund, it means you're foregoing revenue for the general fund. It's zero sum, unless we're creating new revenue. That makes it, you know, that much tougher in the current, you know, for schools or police, as Representative Thompson was saying, or whatever the line item would be, but it helps the permanent fund, and that means, you know, 20, 30, 50 years down the road, you have that much more money. So, I mean, if that could be a part of a greater understanding or decision the legislature wanted to make, I'd be all for it. I just have not personally sort of broached that.
All right, thank you.
Do other members have questions right now? I do. So I guess this really begs the question, is it easier to raise revenue now? Is it easier to raise revenue later? I think when you think about the question of do we grow the fund or do we keep it the same, when we look at the recent transition from oil to earnings to sustain our budget, and it just seems to me that as oil probably inexorably declines on the slope, in general, it's not going to get easier, which is a strong argument for growing the fund now. Is that kind of a fundamental calculation on your part as you look at the POMV rate in the resolution?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I see it a similar way. I mean, 5% is the number that has prevailed most in the legislature, but I mean, when the 5% number was arrived on in the 30th legislature, at least in my recollection, it was like, let's just, you know, get a POMV passed rather than, you know, like a deep compare contrast of like, do we want to manage for growth or do we want to just, you know, manage for the bare minimum and maintain the fund? And I don't think that conversation has been had in as, you know, great depth as it should be. I mean, I know my counterpart in the Senate, he's a strong proponent of a lower draw, a more conservative draw. So the fund isn't maintained or even shrink in real value in time. I sort of subscribe to an approach that it makes sense to sort of suffer from austerity, if you will, or sort of choose austerity in the short term, if it creates much greater prosperity in the long term. So I think, you know, a lower draw would make sense to me, but I think like the bigger goal is to protect the fund in its entirety. But it's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, personally, my preference would be that we look at how do we grow the fund to $100 billion in real terms today, recognizing that when you look at the share of our budget that's currently funded by earnings, that's about where we need to be fiscally independent. And then the question is, how do you grow to that rate with the least economic damage now, maximizing your revenue potential now, which is intimately related to the oil industry? So I just think about the oil industry aspiring to 40 more years, and to some extent that suggests that there won't be much of an oil industry on the slope, maybe, in 40 more years if you kind of just accept that rhetoric at face value, which to me says, gosh, we really need to be fiscally independent in 40 more years since our traditional revenue stream will not be available. And that in turn almost forces one to think about, how do you raise that money from high earning people who are here now so that we can be fiscally independent in the not so distant future when that industry is no longer going to sustain us? So I guess those are some questions that I would be interested in asking Ms. Rodell, because I think as that industry declines, so too do our other revenue options, i.e. income taxes, et cetera. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, to the extent that thinking about the permanent fund as a piece of the, you know, the bigger picture fiscal future for the state of Alaska, I mean, my outlook, independent of restructuring the permanent fund along the lines of the APFC resolution, is that things are quite a bit worse than we think in several terms. I think one is, as you identify, the production decline curve on the North Slope, which has been constant since the late 80s, and there's been sort of incessant talk over the multiple decades since there was an apogee of production in 88, 89, that there's a renaissance coming. And really any renaissance, I think, constitutes just flatlining. I mean, that's a win for us in terms of production. Uncertainty about the price of oil in the future, even prior to the price crash this last week or two, oil stocks have just been pummeled over the last few years, which I think a lot of traders sort of see as the long-term future of energy being undercut by renewables. So if there's low prices, that doesn't portend well for us in terms of petroleum revenues. And also the fact that we've sort of been subsidizing our budget situation by not passing a capital budget the last 6 years, which is wholly unsustainable in a state that is so capital, you know, infrastructure dependent. And so if and when, not when, not if, we start having capital budget, that's a whole nother cash demand that we've been basically ignoring the last couple of years because we can get away with it. So when you sort of take into account all of that, it's a really tough math problem. I think, you know, even harder than sometimes we sort of might think of it in the moment. So which I think just sort of begets the importance of trying to take a long-term view with our assets.
Yeah, and maybe in a subsequent hearing, we could have a little discussion of, you know, some of the intent around creating the permanent fund, because as I recall, Governor Hammond and Hugh Malone were actually pretty explicit that this was to be the renewable energy source for Alaska when oil was gone. And I just feel like we're looking at, you know, that industry is in effectively its middle to older age in this state, and we have a dwindling number of years that we can build up this fund to provide ourselves with fiscal sustainability. And to me, maybe we need to ask ourselves, not only do we need this structure, but can we afford to pay any PFD for potentially multiple years to save up the resources that we need to operate independently? I think those are just questions that we have to ask if we're going to have the fund achieve its original purpose as Alaskans established it. Do other members have questions? Yeah. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. The resolution from the APFC had two different options, one being the one that you moved forward, the second one being the adjustments to the existing rules-based system governing transfers in and out of the principal in the ERA, maintaining 4% or four times the buffer, four times the POMV draw, the 4X buffer they call it, as well as periodic review of the 5% draw. Was there a reason you chose option one over option two?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, it's my understanding that the trustees prefer one over two, but if in the absence of one, two is better than nothing. effectively, I think, two states the sort of wisest way to manage the permanent fund if we're going to accept the current structure. Mm-hmm. It makes sense to me, too. I think if we're not going to act on protecting the entirety of the fund, we should definitely abide by the principles that are outlined.
I appreciate that, certainly. Option one doesn't rely on the wisdom of the legislature year after year after year, while option two does, so I can understand where that's coming from. So that was just my question. Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You brought up the infamous dividend question, and by making a drastic change to our Constitution by rolling the earnings reserve into the corpus and having the 5% draw in there, would you consider having the dividend also enshrined in the Constitution as a part of this package?
Representative Vance, through the chair, no. And I say that as somebody who maybe it surprises some people at the dais, has supported constitutionalizing the dividend and have introduced legislation to that effect in past years. My personal perspective is that the best resolution of the dividend question is putting it in the Constitution. That said, I recognize that there are so many diverse perspectives on the dividend. Among the seven of us, much less the 40 or the 60 of us, that by layering the dividend question on top of the very base question of do we want to protect the permanent fund, is just going to create division, and it will be effectively impossible to get consensus. So from basically a practical perspective, that's why this does not go there. Even though I personally like the idea, I just recognize that there are not enough of us that do.
Well, I'm hoping beyond the impossible and feel like that that we can have, I think it's quite possible that we can have a conversation about what is good for the fund and what is good for Alaskans, for the state and for the people. We're that much closer to getting there. And I think it's definitely the time that we look at that and want to make sure that the people understand the fullness of protecting the fund and the intent behind it. And from the people's perspective, they want to ensure that they are getting their share of the resource as well, because while this constitutional amendment would protect the fund, the people would see that with that percent of draw, that it looks like the state's portion is wrapped up tight, but not theirs. And that's my concern and why I ask. But I do understand the reluctance to make it divisive by adding the dividend question in there. But it is a hurdle that I hope that this body is able to achieve in having that conversation and putting it before a vote of the people. So thank you for your work on that.
Well, this raises a great point, and if I might follow up with a question maybe for the next hearing, I'd like to see some modeling in terms of lifetime earnings from the fund for individual Alaskans if their money, because it is all of our money, is in the fund earning its historic rates versus those which are available to individual people. Because I look at it as I can't earn the same rates of return that the permanent fund can. I don't have that stable of investment managers. But I think it would be interesting to take, a child today and look at what is their lifetime earnings if their money is in the fund versus return to them at a certain rate. And perhaps we can model that out.
Mr. Chair, we can consult with Ledge Finance. I think I understand where you're going with that suggestion.
Do members have further questions at this time? Okay. Does the sponsor have any remarks before we wrap up the first hearing on this resolution?
Mr. Chair, I think this is one of the most important questions the legislature can broach, and it's incredibly timely. And I mean, I think per Representative Vance's comment or in my response to her question, I've been in, had conversations with members of all caucuses, geography, party affiliation. There is a broad agreement that, yes, it does not make sense to overspend the permanent fund. I think, and among Alaskans too. And I think that even though there's this sort of supermajority consensus that that would be a phenomenally unwise thing to do, I think similar to comments I made, it can happen when things are made conditional on whether we do not overspend the permanent fund, be it, you know, passage of an income tax, something that I really think would be wise, or the dividend issue, or any other issue. So there's sort of a rigor and discipline around this and keeping it to the base, broadest coalition, broadest base of support sort of principle, which is we all agree it would be very, very unwise to overspend the permanent fund, to spend down the permanent fund. So that's sort of the guiding philosophy behind this legislation.
Okay. The amendment deadline for this resolution is 5 p.m. Monday, March 16th. We will have public testimony Tuesday, March 17th. At this time, we're going to hold the legislation. Thanks again to House Records staff Martha Moore and LIO moderator Madison Truitt. Our next meeting is Tuesday, March 17th. This meeting is adjourned at 3:59 p.m.